Hello, Eastlake Church, Salt Lake City. How are you doing? This is Kevin McPeak from the Eastlake Church Network, and it's really an honor for me to be with you guys today. I actually was in Salt Lake and got to visit with Pastor Robin about a month ago. I was passing through town and just so excited about what's going on up there. It's really a privilege for me to join you today, even if only on video, because we're looking at an issue here in week four of The Secret Lives of Almost Everyone that's actually very near and dear to my heart, and that is the struggle that so many people have with the mental health issues of anxiety and depression. It's an area where I've had my own struggles, and I'll be sharing kind of my story and my pathway to healing with you guys. And my sincere hope and prayer is that it is hopeful, helpful, and encouraging, whether for you or for someone that you know and care about. So let's jump right into week four of The Secret Lives of Almost Everyone. I can't really remember when it all started. I probably was a teenager when I first noticed it about myself. I had this sort of darkness that kind of followed me around. It was almost like this shadow that followed me. And I would have dark days that would turn into maybe sometimes weeks, but I'd always dig out of it. I'd always get better. But as time went by, I sort of noticed that sometimes it would take longer and longer to get out of these dark times. And even on the best of days, it was almost like there was a cloud in the corner of the sky, like it would be in my spirit and soul, like this bright sunny day, but over in the corner there was always this cloud that was there, and sometimes over time that cloud would come and just fill the whole sky and block out all the light. But I always got better. I always found a way to dig out. Sometime after college, I was married, I had a job, I had great friends. And that darkness came and kind of filled the sky, and it didn't clear, and I couldn't dig out. And it got worse and worse and worse, and day after day turned into week after week, which turned into month after month. And it got to the point where I couldn't get out of bed in the morning, and I would dread the day that was ahead because I would just be kind of chased by these dark thoughts. And I would dread the end of the day because I would just sit there thinking, man, I have to go to bed, and then I have to get up tomorrow morning and I have to face it all again. And I remember feeling like even in the midst of it all, when I was experiencing things that used to be fun, things with my family, things with my friends, it was almost like I was standing outside of myself, watching myself experiencing these things, going, huh, yeah, that used to be fun. Let me do the stuff that makes people think I'm having fun. Let me put on the fun face. But deep inside, I was just kind of dead and lifeless to the whole thing. In the middle of it all, I felt so much like these words from Psalm 13. How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? And that feeling went on day after day, like the scripture says, and night after night, and week after week, and month after month. Until one of those evenings, I remember getting to that same spot of just dreading having to get up the next morning. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't have to. I don't have to get up tomorrow. I could do something about this, and I wouldn't have to get up tomorrow. And I realized what was happening. I was very clinically and very unemotionally thinking about, well, I could just end my own life. I could do that. And how could I do it in a way that would do the least damage to the people who care about me? And at that moment, a miracle occurred. And I know it might strike you as the smallest miracle in the world, but my brain went, whoa. Wait a second, we've crossed a line here. We're sort of over a bridge now where we're thinking about things like ending life. And the miracle was my brain sort of observed itself and said, no, this is one step too far. We gotta stop and we gotta get help here. And for me, that sudden realization, man, I got to do something. I got to get some help. Again, that for me was a miracle. Now, I want to jump ahead to now and skip over the days and weeks and months and even years that followed that time and let you know this. I'm still here. I'm okay. In fact, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. And the reason I tell you that story is because there are so many people that are struggling with mental health issues of anxiety and depression. And I just want to tell you this. There is hope. You can be in the darkest place, but there is hope and there is always hope. See, we're in week 4 of this series, The Secret Lives of Almost Everyone, and we've been looking at these things that we struggle with often in secret. And in week 1, we talked about this idea that it's okay not to be okay. And this week, as I said, we're talking about anxiety and depression and other mental health issues, and I want to be really clear that talking about these things is okay. For me, I talk about it openly and honestly, and I talk about it a lot. If you were here earlier this summer, I talked about it as a part of a different sermon that I did. In fact, I'm starting to get a little self-conscious about it because I think I'm going to develop a reputation as like the depressed pastor. And I don't want that. It'd be like, you know, how everybody thinks about James as the guy who has too many basketball sneakers and Mike's the guy who like smoked a lot of weed in high school. So I'm careful. Like, I'm going to talk about it today and then we'll step away from it for a little while. But talking about it honestly and openly, it's been really helpful for me. And honestly, I believe it's been helpful for other people to go, okay, I'm not alone. And so today we're going to talk about those issues. But you might be thinking, well, you know, hey, man, I'm glad you're doing better. And that's great. But it's not an issue for me. And I understand that. But I want to share a couple of statistics with you because I think they're pretty striking. According to the Center for Disease Control, almost half of U.S. adults will struggle with some mental illness over the course of their lifetime. About 60 million Americans, that's basically one out of every five, is going to experience mental health issues in a given year. 18% of adults and 8% of adolescents experience an anxiety disorder in a given year. 9% of adults and 8% of adolescents experience depression in a given year. And post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, it affects 4% of the general population, but among veterans, well, the numbers are staggering. For our Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, the numbers are closer to 20%. And the Rand Corporation issued that number, and even they think that might be a little bit low. So even if you don't directly struggle with anxiety, depression, PTSD, or another mental health issue, I can guarantee you this. You know someone who does. You absolutely know someone who does. And you might not even know that you know someone who does, because sometimes we hide behind these issues. So the first thing I want to do is actually speak to the wider community, to speak to all of us, because there's a lot we can do to support people who are going through these mental health struggles. So at all of our locations, wherever you are, I'd like you to take out your outline and look at the first fill-in, which is this. It's something very important. As a community, we must remove the stigma surrounding mental illness. For as long as there have been people, there's been mental illness. It's a part of our broken, fallen condition, but it's there, it's a part of being human. And regrettably, we've really dismissed and shunned people who have struggled with these issues. In fact, we've used words that are very dismissive. Think about what's the word that immediately comes to mind? Crazy. We use the word crazy as an insult. Think about it, when there's someone you disagree with very strongly or you don't like what they say, you go, oh man, that guy's crazy. And that's the word that was used to talk about people who struggle with mental health issues all the way back even to the 1500s. It was used to describe people who were diseased. And the original meaning of the word crazy comes from this notion of being full of cracks. Well, actually, the brilliant theologian and philosopher Dave Chappelle had a great quote about this that struck me so strongly when I first heard him say it. He said, this is what happens when we talk about people being crazy. He said, the worst thing to call somebody is crazy. It's dismissive. I don't understand this person, so they're crazy. These people are not crazy. They're strong people. Maybe their environment is a little sick. I think even well-intentioned people can mess this up. And honestly, a lot of times it's well-intentioned people inside of the church. I remember a conversation I had with a guy a while ago, and he knew the Bible a lot better than I did. And he'd been a Christian a lot longer than I had. And he said, you know, if you look in the Bible, there's a passage that dismisses all of the mental health issues and all of psychology. And he turned to 2 Timothy 1:7, and it says, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind. And I remember him emphasizing sound mind, and he pointed at him in this Bible, and he kind of poked at the Bible so hard I felt like he was poking me in the chest. And what he was saying was, if you are a Christian, if you're a follower of God, well, you're guaranteed to have a sound mind. And if you struggle with any mental health issues, well, you're probably not doing this faith thing right. And you know, in the church, we sometimes tell people things like, well, you just have to you have to pray it away. Or the reason you have these issues is, you know, you just don't have enough faith. Well, I think it's maybe a little bit more complicated than that. And certainly when it comes to that scripture, it's actually a mistranslation. If you look at the original Greek, the word that's used actually translates better as self-control, self-discipline, not sound mind. It's a very, very different notion. Most translations actually say self-control or self-discipline. The other thing that we overlook in all of this is that Jesus did not live a pain-free, sorrow-free life. Scripture talks about him as being someone who is familiar with pain and suffering and sorrow. In the book of Isaiah, which is actually an Old Testament book, it predates Jesus. So that means it came before him, but it describes in prophecy this person that would be the Messiah. And we as Christians believe Jesus Christ is that Messiah. And it said this about that Messiah to come in Isaiah 53. It said, he was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that Jesus was clinically depressed or had an anxiety disorder or any other mental health issue. I'm absolutely convinced he didn't. But my point is, the life of Jesus was not a sorrow-free life. We sometimes get this notion, and I don't know why we get it, that if you're walking in faith as a Christian, it's just going to be happy, happy, happy all the time, like Jesus was a member of the Wiggles or something. That's not how it works. And that's not who he was, and that was not his experience. See, if we miss that key part of his life, that he was familiar with sorrow, then we miss a key part of interacting with other people. And that's why we as a faith community must welcome and love those who struggle with mental health issues. Remember, in the first week of the series, we said, it's okay to not be okay. And we said it because we actually believe that. If you're struggling with a mental health issue, I want you to know this, okay? You're welcome here. We love you, we care about you, and we don't think any less of you because of your struggle. Some of you are struggling with these issues, and you hide behind a facade. And the reason I say this is because I did the same thing. You put up the happy face, and you try to convince everybody that everything's okay, but you don't have to do that here. And the reason you don't have to do that here is because we don't want to see the facade. We actually want to see the real you. And we want to see the real you, even if the real you is a little bit broken and a little bit struggling. So you don't need to hide and pretend that you're okay. If you've got some mess, well, look around this room. There's plenty of mess in this room, right? We all bring our own issues as we come through the doors. Now, secondly, I want to do something that I don't ordinarily do. I want to speak directly to our online campus and the people who are watching live on Facebook. If you didn't know this, we have an online campus, and we stream our services live on Facebook, and there's a reason we do that. We've heard so many great stories about people on deployment who get to experience our services that way, people who are traveling for work or for family or for kids' sports, or they're sick or their child is sick, and they'd otherwise miss service, and they're able to watch online, and that is awesome. So if you are watching online, we love you. We love the community that you formed there, and we're so excited that you're a part of it. But I do want to say this. I know what anxiety and depression can do. And it can make you fearful of going into public places. And it can make you fearful of interacting with people. And if that's the thing that's keeping you from coming to services in person at one of our churches, I want to challenge you to test us. And here's what I mean. Test us and see if you come here, will you find friendly people? Because I believe that you will. What I've seen on our patio is sometimes it's kind of amazing. I'll see people walk up and somebody comes up and gives them a hug. And I go, I wonder if they've met before. Because sometimes people here, they're just so friendly and non-judgmental that it can just bring people in. So if you're watching online and you're fearful, you're like, yeah, I'd like to come, but I think people would think less of me because of the issues I'm struggling with. No, I think you'd find if you come here, you'd be accepted. Now, I will say, if you come here and you really don't want somebody to give you a hug, just get that arm out front, like aim for the solar plexus, and you can block the hug before they come in if you get that arm out. It's a good technique. That's a free tip for you. But I would strongly encourage you to be that community, and for you who are attending to come and join that community. See, our job is to empathize with those who are hurting. Look at the words of Romans 12. Share the happiness of those who are happy and the sorrow of those who are sad. See, what this means is that we're here to celebrate with people when things are going great, and we're there to share their pain when things aren't going so great. My wife is awesome at this. If you come up to my wife with some good news and tell her, hey, this thing happened in my life, she will celebrate with you, she will get up, and she will dance with you. That is way better than me getting up and dancing with you, because nobody wants to see that. But if something's going bad in your life, she's also that person who will throw her arm around you. She will cry with you if things are going wrong. And one of the things that we can all do that she does that I'm always inspired by this is she'll say to somebody, can I pray for you? And when they say yes, she doesn't go, okay, I'll do that this week. She prays with them right now. Right in that moment, she just stops and prays with them. And it's such a powerful thing that she does that we can all do to share the sorrow of those who are in pain. It's an opportunity for us to empathize. If you look at the flip side of that, though, there's a challenge. See, we can empathize, but the flip side of it is that we've got to resist the urge to fix those who are struggling. If you've ever been through our growth group leader training, you know that we talk about this, okay? Your job isn't to fix people. We leave that to the Holy Spirit, and it's in capable hands. Because oftentimes, when we see people dealing with anxiety, worry, depression, other mental health issues, see, what we often want to do is get them to change their mind about it. And folks, that's not really how it works. We expect them to realize that their mindset is unproductive, so that all they need to do is really just reach down and pull themselves up by their bootstraps and snap out of it. Well, folks, I can tell you from experience, you can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps when the bootstraps are gone. You can't snap out of it when the part of you that needs to snap is just broken and fractured. It's not something that people can just change their mind about. Around the year 400, St. Augustine wrote his Confessions. And he wrote this beautiful way of loving others. He said this, what does love look like? It has the hands to help others. It has the feet to hasten to the poor and needy. It has eyes to see misery and want. It has the ears to hear the sighs and sorrows of men. That is what love looks like. See, I love that phrase, to hear the ears to hear the sighs and sorrows of men. See, it doesn't say a mouth to give people a to-do list of the things they need to fix about themselves. It doesn't say a mouth to tell them to snap out of it or change their mind about it. It just says that we listen and hear the sighs and the sorrows of other people. See, for most of us, unless we're trained professionally, our job is not to fix. Our job is to just listen, encourage, care, and comfort. Even if that person is someone that's very dear to you, your job is not to fix them. Your job is to support them and encourage them. Jesus himself spoke of what would come for those in mourning. He said, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Note, it doesn't say, oh, they'll be fixed. It says they'll be comforted. And that's our role, to offer comfort and encouragement where we can. Now, with the time that we have remaining, I want to pivot a little bit, and I do want to speak very directly to those of us in the room who are struggling with these issues. And you think, well, maybe that's not me. Over the course of your life, one out of every two U.S. adults struggles with some sort of mental health issue. And so it's actually a large part of this room that is going to confront these issues at some point in their lives. And so as individuals who struggle, we must be honest about our pain. Now, this might seem really obvious or really small, but it's actually hugely important. You've got to be serious about confronting the reality of your experience. Look at the words of Psalm 139. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me. Know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. It's saying, God, search me. Look inside of me. Know my heart. Test me. And then help me to identify the things that need to be fixed and then lead me in this. Let me follow you to a path of healing. Now, a part of being honest is also recognizing that not every anxiety is indication of an anxiety disorder. Not every bad day is an indication of clinical depression, because sometimes it's just life. We experience worry, and we experience sorrow, and we experience loss, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a mental health issue. We can't categorize everything that way, and that's a part of being honest with ourselves. The comedian Stephen Wright talked about this the first time he ever experienced anxiety. He said, when I turned 2, I was really anxious because I doubled my age in a year. I thought, if this keeps up, by the time I'm 6, I'll be 90. See, part of being honest with all of these things is that not everything you experience is going to be an anxiety disorder or any other sort of clinical depression kind of an issue. We all experience these things. My friend is a psychologist, and he works in a part of the country where they have long and really cold winters, and it gets dark. You know, the days are long and the nights are long and the days are short where he's at. It's just cold and just kind of crummy, which is why all of us live in San Diego. Anyway, so he lives in this part of the country, and people in the middle of that will come and see him because they're just depressed and they're having a hard time. And so he is an outstanding psychologist. He listens to them. He inventories what's going on. He's taking notes. He's very attentive to all the details. And at the end of an hour of questioning and conversation, he says, "Well, I've listened to everything that's going on, and I've come to a diagnosis. And what you have is called February. And you're going to be okay because February is going to end, and you'll be all right." Now, he doesn't do that with everybody because there are people who are coming in with very, very serious issues. But sometimes this honesty about ourselves is just, we're just going through a tough time. And we just have to keep moving and keep walking through so we can do a little bit better. That said, I do want to invite a particular community into an honest conversation about themselves and about what's going on, because I think there's more going on than just a hard time. And that is, I want to speak to the veterans. Because the statistics regarding PTSD for our veterans, those statistics are staggering. The Veterans Administration released a study indicating that 22 veterans commit suicide every day. That's one every 65 minutes. Veterans make up about 18% of the suicides in this country, but they're only about 8% of the population. And so, to veterans, I want to say this. First, thank you. We honor you for your service. And secondly, I want to be really, really clear about this. Post-traumatic stress disorder and depression have nothing to do with an inability to handle things. They have nothing to do with weakness. They have nothing to do with you not being strong enough to manage what you've seen or experienced. Every shred of evidence and investigation says the opposite. That it's not about an individual's weakness or an individual's strength. PTSD has nothing to do with those issues. And if you believe that, you've been fed a lie, because it's a much, much more complicated issue than that. The number one issue that faces veterans, the number one issue that keeps them from getting the help that they need, is this misperception that they're asking for help because they're weak. A friend of mine works with veterans, and he says that's the number one issue that keeps them away, this fear that they'll be viewed as less than because they asked for help. The third thing I want to say to our veterans is, we love you way too much to let you suffer in silence. You can't suffer in silence. You've got to stand up and seek help if you need it. This is a community that loves you and supports you and wants you to get well. And so if you need any help with that, we've got resources available to help you. You see, trauma isn't about emotional strength or lack thereof. See, you've got a God-given system that's designed to protect you from harm. And when that system gets overwhelmed, it locks up the system. It basically freezes. And understand that when that happens, it's not an indication of weakness any more than you breaking your arm is an indication of weakness, or being diagnosed with cancer is an indication of weakness. No one would think that someone who's suffering from cancer is doing so because of weakness. And yet somehow we put this expectation on people who are dealing with PTSD. It's a falsehood that keeps people from getting the help that they need. And so just like a broken bone or cancer, the important next step that we need to have for people who are struggling is this: we need to seek help. See, whether we're talking about these veterans with PTSD or new moms battling with postpartum depression, or grown men that have suddenly out of nowhere these panic attacks, or a teenager battling with depression, yes, the first step is important, to say, I've got a problem. But the second step is just as important. You got to get help. You have to find a way to step up and get help, because mental health issues often aren't going to get any better if they're left unaddressed. Just like a broken bone, they can actually get worse if they're not treated. See, I believe that God doesn't want you to suffer through these issues. I believe that he wants you to seek out help and make use of the resources that are available to you. If you look on your outline, you're actually going to find at the bottom of that an online listing that we've created that you can go to, and it will give you books, resources, blogs, websites, counselors, all kinds of people that you can connect with and get information from to start this process of seeking help. But seek the help. Heck, talk to your doctor if that's what you need to do. But start the process of seeking help if you're in that place. Secondly, I want to be really, really clear about this. This is really important. Do not self-diagnose and do not self-medicate. I come from a family, an extended family, with an unfortunate history of alcoholism. And I sincerely believe that that alcoholism is because there's actually a long history of depression in the family. And we as a society, we haven't done really well with talking with people and treating depression. So I think a lot of stuff went undiagnosed and untreated, and people just self-medicated with alcohol. And then that turned into alcoholism and alcohol dependency. So let me say very, very clearly, do not do this. It does not go well. For me, I'll admit one of the problems I had in my course of treatment that went on for a long time is I had grown so tired of people telling me to kind of pray it away or you know, have more faith to get rid of the issue that I just wanted it all to be biochemical. I just wanted somebody to give me a pill and I would just be better. And so I was very reluctant to address what was going on inside of my mind and inside of my soul and spirit. And so I really struggled with those issues. But I don't think there's any question that anxiety and depression can have a biochemical component to them. I mean, every bit of evidence suggests that that's not always the case, but in many cases, it absolutely is the case. And so if your course of treatment includes medication, let me say this very clearly, take your meds, okay? This is something I talk with people a lot. They'll come to me because I've talked about my struggle in the past, and they'll say, yeah, you know, I've been prescribed this stuff, but I don't want to take it. And I will always say, if you broke your arm and they said, hey, we got to put a cast on it, would you say, nah, I don't want people to think less of me? No, if they've given you a prescription for medication, take the medication. And importantly, when you start to feel better, don't go, oh, I'm doing better. I don't need the medication anymore. No, that's the medication working. That's why you're feeling better. And if it doesn't work the first time, go back and get different medication. See, I've had great counseling and I've had great therapy, but I'll be very honest with you. I think part of the reason I'm standing in front of you alive today is because Paxil works as advertised. I mean, as the saying goes, God made us family, but Prozac made us friends. And it, for me, I haven't had to be on my medication for a long time. I'm doing great, but I did have to be on it for a couple of years, and it leveled me off. A friend of mine who works in mental health issues, he talks about when there's medication, a lot of times with anxiety and depression, you got to walk up a big hill. And it's too steep for you to walk up. And if the medication does nothing else for you, it just helps it get a little easier for you to walk up that hill. But don't deny, even as we talk about these biochemical issues, don't deny the significance of your faith as you walk through these issues. That was something that was really crucial for me, and that really helped to unlock a lot in my healing and doing a lot better. See, if we boil this down to being just some biochemical issue, we're missing a big part of what's happening. See, you are more than just a body, and you're more than just a mind. See, your body, soul, and spirit. Look at the words of 1 Thessalonians. It says, now may the God of peace make you holy in every way, and may your whole spirit and soul and body be kept blameless until our Lord Jesus Christ comes again. See, we're all of those things. We're spirit, we're soul, and we're body. And if we try to heal one without attention to the others, well, our healing's not going to be complete. See, at the center of all of that is our faith in Jesus. And don't get me wrong, I believe firmly that Jesus can still miraculously heal. But I believe he does that with body, soul, and spirit integrated all together. And that leads us to our final point, which is this. We must embrace that our illness is not our identity. If you have a broken ankle, you are not a broken ankle. If you've been diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, you are not ALS. It doesn't define who you are. See, I am not my depression. If you're a follower of Jesus, your primary identity is in Jesus.